Welcome to the Reaction Podcast with me, Ian Martin, editor of Reaction. Apologies, there hasn't been a podcast the last few weeks. I've been away and various members of the Reaction team have been off ill, but everyone now recovered and back in full next week. But I'm happy to say I'm joined this week by my friend and colleague, Tim Montgomery, and we're going to talk through, well, a couple of things, Tim. I mean, we're just before this, we're saying, let's try and find something really optimistic to talk about. Conscious that, you know, there's a new the news agenda, the global agenda is not relentlessly upbeat at the moment. And we came up with the cricket, England's victory in the cricket, which is obviously very, very good news. But apart from that, let's plunge in first, Tim, and talk about the Tory leadership. It's now 10 days, nearly 2 weeks since the vote of confidence in Boris Johnson, 148 MPs against him, 211 in favour. Where do you think things stand now?
I actually, my general belief, Ian, is, you know, you and I are people who, after the referendum result, were very clear, I think correctly, that, you know, the people had voted, the rules were clear, the rules of the game were clear, and we had to accept the result. And I think there has to be an element of that also with the vote of MPs that took place in the no confidence vote. I think both you and I, let's say, are not the greatest fans of the Prime Minister. And I certainly would have voted against him in the confidence vote. But although it was close, he won it. And I think he's deserved some time to sort of put things right, to confound his critics. I don't think he's using it well, though. I have to say, it's early days if, you know, we're talking about giving him 6 to 12 months. But even a couple of nights ago, I met a right-wing Conservative MP, you know, on the right of the party, Eurosceptic Brexiteer, who had backed the Prime Minister in the confidence vote. And they made it very clear to me that the only thing that was really holding them back from ousting the Prime Minister was the lack of emergence of an obvious successor. And so I get the feeling that there's real complacency in Downing Street. I think they're carrying on more or less as they were. But if that conversation I had with one MP, which has sort of also been, you know, the flavour of other conversations I've had with Conservative MPs over the last 2 weeks, if those sort of conversations are true, and I think, you know, they are reflective of general opinion, I think things could yet move quite quickly against the Prime Minister.
Do you think he's helped then just by there not being an obvious successor at the moment? It's obviously going to be a bit like the Grand National if there is a leadership contest with loads of people standing. You think those sometimes these things surprise you when it comes to the Tory party.
Wacky races.
Yeah, but you sort of never know what emerges in terms of some kind of stitch-up or attempted compromise behind a unity candidate. But say there is a leadership race, I mean, there's so much confusion and there isn't a clear front runner. So you're saying he's there, he's kept on almost by default. How long does he have to turn it around if that's feasible?
Well, it depends upon the, you know, intermediary events. We've obviously had the resignation of Lord Geit. Is that how you pronounce it? Lord
yes.
Geit this week. And that turned out to be not as explosive as it might have been if the reason for his resignation had been other, more publicly sensitive things. Publicly potent things.
Yeah.
But it may not take much more than another event like that. We've also got the Privileges Committee reporting probably later in the year. You know, there's plenty of things that could happen at any one moment, I think, to blow up this premiership. And, you know, all it takes is for a cabinet minister or two to react to that. And suddenly, you know, things could move quite quickly. The general sense I get, though, from Conservative MPs who actually voted for the Prime Minister last week, but actually do want him gone by the time of the next election, is they do want the Prime Minister to suck up the difficulties of the next 6 to 9 months. You know, this has been a big theme of your recent writing and tweeting, Ian. Mm. We're not going into good economic times. They're going to be a lot tougher than what we've already experienced, what families are already feeling the crunch. It's going to get harder. And I think the general view is, why change leader during that period when, you know, let Boris suck all that pain up and the new leader can come in when, well, who knows when the worst is going to be over, but when at least some of the worst is behind us, and that they can start with a sort of a fresh oomph and a fresh agenda to tackle what are very big problems.
And I suppose there's a concern they might have that any new leader would be instantly tainted or ruined by what's about to happen. We're going to come on and talk about inflation and cost of living and what's happening in the global economy in a in a little while. But there's a danger there that if it was a Hunt or a Liz Truss or a Sajid Javid or any of the other sort of 10 or so contenders, they become prime minister and then they take the blame for what I think is going to be a summer of crisis.
Yeah, and I think we've had the Bank of England's interest rate decision, but I think there'll be plenty more pressure on households just through the remorseless increase of prices. I think the most interesting, sorry if I'm slightly preempting what you want us to move on to, but
no, not at all.
If prices are going to start, hitting 11%, I just I think you just had a Sainsbury's delivery, being more of a man of the people. I was in Poundland this morning, Ian, so Poundland, just little things like, for ages they've been selling milk at just over a pound, but now it's up to £1.25. That's my observation. It's remorseless, absolutely remorseless. Every time I feel I go into the shops now,
you
notice items, increased in price. And, I think both of us are probably not easy, but, both of us are able to afford it. But there's plenty of people out there who really, really are struggling. Now, I was talking to, one of the management team in my local Tesco's, and they were talking about, quite a big increase they're now noticing in shoplifting and attempted shoplifting. And they're not young people stealing cider. It's young mums, trying to take chicken and mince, out of the store. And it's a very difficult thing because they don't really want to charge these people because they know how hard it is, but neither do they want to send a message to the rest of the town, the rest of the city, that Tesco's is, not prosecuting. So, but I was struck, this is people are being forced into actions that they never normally would contemplate. And that's before a lot of the worst has hit.
Yeah, it feels very precarious because what you're describing there, Tim, is millions of people, millions of families who may have been what used to be called...
Just managing
was the old political slogan, or just getting by, which Ed Miliband used to use in a... what now seems like a kind of golden era of relatively low inflation. And it's those people, just millions of them, those families, just on the line, just getting by. And I think the thing that strikes me is I think it's underpriced. And you mentioned it there, is just this has just started. Now, I know there are discussions among economists about whether it's peaked or actually it's going to peak in the autumn. Even if that is the case, and I'm not necessarily convinced it is, because if you look at what's happening to energy and some of the problems there are in the energy market and deliveries of gas and what's happening with petrol as well, I'm not convinced it is going to get that much easier later in the year. But even so, the next 6 months, these are families that are going to be going from just getting by to real financial distress. And I doubt that they'll feel relaxed about it. The thing that I was going to mention just on the 148 number, I mean, that's where I think there is also scope for inflation in terms of that number of Tory MPs. It's 148 who voted no confidence in Boris Johnson. But as you've already said, Tim, among the 211, and I've spoken to several who voted for Boris or claimed to, who knows who's telling the truth in these circumstances.
You're not suggesting a Conservative MP would tell an untruth to
a... I know it's an appalling thought, but let's entertain for a second the outlandish possibility that people were claiming to have voted one way and then might have voted the other in the secrecy of the ballot box. But that 148, what I think may be happening is that 148, with every blow there is to the Prime Minister's authority or setback, like the resignation of Geith, though it was a rather strange affair and it was over steel tariffs and him being asked to turn a blind eye effectively to the breach of the ministerial code. So it was all a bit too technical for people to get that worked up about. I still think it is, as a Tory MP put it to me, that's probably worth another 10. So yep. If 148 becomes 158 and he's then on 201 notionally, every time you get something like this, which is the economic situation gets worse, a new spike in inflation goes higher faster than anticipated, or there's some kind of scandal to come, or just some accident that befalls the government, that 148 is not going to go down. It's only going to go up. And then going into the autumn, well, that's where I think he's in real difficulties if he makes it to the party conference, which is that when you get these moments of economic crisis, and I think back to what it felt like in sort of late summer, early autumn 1992, and the build up to Britain falling out of the ERM, and I think what's coming this time in terms of inflation and global markets is much more serious. You could just feel that you were moving into a crisis period. Same in 2007, 2008, can happen slowly, actually really begins in 2006. It's a kind of 18 month build up until the full denouement. It feels to me as though, I don't know what you think, Tim, we're heading into one of those summer and autumns of crisis. Now, in those circumstances, what history tells you is that people then look to their leaders and they really want to be reassured that said person knows what they're about and is comfortable with economics and speaks with authority, and that their word carries some weight in these matters.
Yeah.
Now, there are many things you can say about Boris Johnson. That what I've just described is true of Gordon Brown, who I'm not particularly a fan of. Certainly true of Alistair Darling. Would have been true of Nigel Lawson. Was true of Geoffrey Howe and Margaret Thatcher. They all had they had some weight and authority on economics, and they had a story to tell. I thought one of the most interesting things I've read this week was Michael Gove at the Times CEO Summit, which is back on in person. Gove was quoted about inflation, saying essentially, look, it's going to be difficult, you can't help everyone, but the government is working to reduce inflation. And it was almost as though Michael Gove was going through the motions, using, because he has a knowledge of history, using the rhetoric of the 90s or the coalition period, because Cameron and Osborne had a plan, whether you agreed with it or not, they had a plan and had more authority on these matters than Boris Johnson. And it was almost as though Michael Gove was just parroting these lines. He didn't quite say, if it isn't hurt, if it's not hurting, it's not working. The slogan from, that's from the 90s, isn't it?
Lamont, or was it Lamont or Major? One of the two,
yeah. Yeah, and it's the reason that, so the markets, who don't sort of think as one, but analysts and investors think and take a view, is that essentially they've worked out that there isn't a plan. So what Michael Gove was saying was really sounded empty, hollow, because we know that the Bank of England starts this, is hiking rates. It's a long way behind the curve. It missed the inflation that was coming, or underestimated the potential for inflation to get out of hand. We know that the Treasury and Number 10 don't necessarily see eye to eye on much. And so at the heart of British economic policy, well, there isn't really a policy. Am I being too harsh?
No, I don't think you're being too harsh. The big question I have at the moment, look, I absolutely agree, Britain doesn't really have an economic policy, and it doesn't have an economic policy at the time. We're going into some very choppy times. Now, Boris is probably going to hang around for a little while at least, but the one person that could change is Rishi Sunak, because he's partly responsible for this vacuum as well. What I can't work out, whether moving Rishi Sunak out and installing a chancellor who could bring some order to that is the right thing to do, or just the fact of moving Rishi Sunak, changing the chancellor at already a difficult time would actually spook the markets more than the solution. And I generally don't know the answer to that. And I suspect we probably will carry on in this slightly muddy, compromised position that we are. But
it's a good question. I mean, I don't know the answer to that in terms of changing chancellor, because there is a Britain has a perception problem at the moment. There's no doubt.
Yeah.
Now, anti-Brexiteers will say this is all about Brexit and reckless law breaking and all, you know, lawlessness and the behaviour of Boris Johnson and all the rest of it. Maybe exaggerating the case a bit, but there's something in it. There are the circumstances there almost for a, I don't want to sound too alarmist, almost like a run on Britain, almost a kind of run on confidence that the institutions are functioning properly. I mean, the Bank of England looks really adrift at the moment and a long way off the pace.
I was quite surprised it only raised interest rates by a quarter point yesterday. I thought, particularly after the Fed had moved in the way it had, I thought we would have seen a bolder move. And of course, three members of the Monetary Policy Committee did want that bolder move.
Yes.
The bank moved too slowly at the beginning of this crisis, and we all make mistakes, but I think to keep moving as slowly as they are seems to be compounding that initial hesitancy.
So the argument is, Tim, that the risk here is of tipping Britain into recession, which may already be the case. Britain might already be experiencing a recession, but you make it deeper or you guarantee a recession if you raise rates so fast that it just crashes the economy. That's the theory, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it's a very difficult balance. And I think in normal economic times, it would be a difficult decision to make. But we've had so many surprise sort of turn of events because of the pandemic, post-pandemic. You know, I think that the consensus certainly was during the time when governments were throwing an enormous amount of money into furlough schemes or their national equivalents, that when those furlough schemes were withdrawn, we'd go in for a period of quite big unemployment. The reverse has been the case. You know, certainly at the moment, vacancy measures in Britain are at record highs, although inactivity rates are also a problem. But we've ended up with inflation rather than unemployment. And so I can understand why anyone having to navigate through these times would be hesitant.
Mm.
But I think just generally, you know, we've never really had a period of inflation that hasn't been partly sorted out by having to slow the economy down quite a lot and, you know, enter at least a brief period of recession to bring prices back down. So I think the idea of avoiding a recession is for the birds, actually. A recession is coming, and it's just a question of, you know, how that recessionary adjustment period is navigated.
Yeah, because there's a theory that that essentially we've, because of the way that policymakers have handled the last 20 years or so, or the period, or certainly the period since the financial crisis, they've always found a way through QE, crude shorthand, money printing, ultra low rates. They've always found a way to sort of skirt round the crisis. And the emphasis has always been keeping the show on the road, as it was with the furlough scheme, which I understand why it's popular, though I do, and people were, you know, feeling very anxious and needed reassurance, and it did keep the show on the road. But I do wonder whether historians, economic historians, longer term will see that with the benefit of hindsight as maybe having been a mistake and done strange things to the labour market.
I'm sure on a bigger level, history is going to be very unkind to the whole idea of lockdown and therefore the measures like furlough that were taken to support.
I mean, I wouldn't. There's just one thing I would say, just to sort of balance things on the question of Britain and its institutions and the thing I mentioned, you know, lack of confidence potentially, or trust, market trust in British institutions. It's not, I mean, Britain's got it particularly bad, I think, at the moment because there are doubts about the Prime Minister's interest or authority, you know, authority when it comes to matters economic. And, you know, as we've outlined, we don't really have a kind of coherent British economic policy, but it's not as though there is unity in other parts of the world and in the developed economies. Central banks are also struggling there because we're at the end of a very long period, aren't we, where there was broadly a consensus, and we could debate where that begins. Is it a post 1973 end of one monetary system, or is it what happens with 79 and the arrival of Thatcher and the monetarist experiment, which has tried for a while? Or is it what Paul Volcker, the famous American US central banker, did towards the end of the Carter administration and then under Reagan to really get inflation under control? But there's a way of thinking about money and about how you control inflation while having simultaneously completely open global financial markets so money can move around. And it then runs into Greenspan and Greenspan's idea post the kind of tech bubble bursting 20 years, more than 20 years ago, that you then manage every crisis you just sort of smooth it out and you try to effectively avoid recessions. With cheap money and other sort of devices. And for a long time, it seemed to work, or it seemed to be working, though maybe actually the thing that was really doing it was just trade with China, to be blunt. That's what was keeping prices low. And it wasn't the genius of Western central bankers. So you now run into this period of, I know trade is still happening and not going to disappear, but it is a period of deglobalization, with people shortening their supply lines and trying to make themselves, countries trying to make themselves more resilient. So there's deglobalization happening, plus you're kind of at the end of a monetary experiment, and there isn't a clear thing or model to replace it with yet. So you've got, I think this might be why you've got this division between different central banks. So it's not just that Britain didn't raise rates by enough. Japan is still sticking with ultra cheap money and not following the Fed. So it's the Fed that's being very, very aggressive and trying to take a sort of Volcker approach and really try and tackle inflation that way. The Bank of England in the middle, trying to raise a bit, but not so much that it crashes the economy, and Japan going in a different direction. So
that's absolutely fascinating, Ian. That's a lot of food for thought.
And it's not so. I'm just seeking to not completely exonerate Sunak and the Bank of England, because Britain has its own problems, but there is a bigger story.
Yeah, I'm going to have to re-listen to this podcast myself now and listen to everything you've just said, because that's a lot of interesting thoughts in there. And I think that's particularly that central thought that maybe it was China's sort of enter into the global market, flooding the world really with cheap manufactured goods and keeping inflation down, more than the central bank's supposed brilliance. That's a really interesting alternative theory.
I mean, the other thing is to touch on is Ukraine, where, I mean, my concern, and we're going from potential economic disaster, and I'm not predicting that. You always hope in these situations, and sometimes it happens. The authorities get away with things. Inflation turns out to not be quite as bad. You catch a couple of lucky breaks at some point in the next 6 months. Inflation starts to subside, and you have a short recession, and then a powerful recovery. But there's a lot going on in geopolitics, which also points to long sustained disruption, because the war in Ukraine is not ending anytime soon. And Putin is playing for, it's very clear what his strategy is now, having launched this horrendous assault on Ukraine and then being dragged into, through his own military, through his own strategic military incompetence, into a long conflict. His game is clearly is to try and play this long on gas and energy and to really squeeze the West, and to ensure that, as he sees it, you get some sort of divide in the West at some point in the next 6 months to a year. I think that's really what was behind the Macron and Scholz visit to Kiev this week.
Wasn't that Macron Zelensky photo amazing?
I really found it quite an upsetting image, actually, after everything that's happened. And he just seemed to be, Zelensky, someone who I, like many of us, admire a lot, just for Macron to sort of switched his public relations position, and to then in such a, I don't know, just such a blatant way to hug him and try and make him part of the Macron photo opportunity. I found really quite sickening, yeah. Actually.
Just the way Zelensky, he is obviously a comedian by background, he's an actor. The way he was kind of looking at the camera, not saying anything, but you could sort of, the speech bubble you could have put on top was, really? Really? I just thought it was absolutely brilliant. But my goodness, Zelensky's shorter than I thought. You know, if he's that short against Macron, that's quite something.
He is, yeah, he's not.
I'm being very trivial now.
Yeah, but a lot of great sort of military figures have been not necessarily, very.
Just advertising another podcast, Potomac Watch. I always get that slight pronunciation wrong, but from the Wall Street Journal, they do a daily politics podcast on the USA. And there's one early in this week that they focused on the situation in Ukraine and in the East, and just the huge imbalance there is now between the artillery of the Russians and the Ukrainians. And Ukraine are sort of basically taking 200 casualties a day, not fatalities, casualties, some of which are fatalities, but just the pounding by Russian artillery, which have, by some accounts, advantages of 20 to 1 in basic equipment and ammunition. And it's just absolutely terrorizing. And Ukraine will not be able to, no country could sustain that level of casualty, for much longer. And, while we've been talking about climate change and the cost of living and Boris Johnson's woes, it is interesting how much Ukraine has disappeared from the top of the news agenda, relegated to, sort of other items almost. But actually, we have an initial absolute obsession, quite rightly, with that conflict. We saw Ukraine outperform all expectations for a while. But I'm beginning to have my first real worries about Ukraine really going backwards. That could cause all sorts of political problems for Zelensky. It could empower China as it watches, as Russia reasserts itself. And I just really wonder when another sort of caption for that Zelensky Macron photo. Yeah, okay, a cuddle's lovely, an EU offer's lovely, but can we not just have some artillery and some bombs? Because that's what they really need. And Britain has been good. And I think we've just, Ben Wallace, the Defence Secretary, has just acquired, I think, through a Belgian arms manufacturer, 20 more high velocity artillery weapons to send to Ukraine on basically the secondary market. Why are we having, to do this and other countries in the EU or America can't? But there's the war is not going well at the moment, continuing our cheery theme of this podcast.
Yeah.
And I think we need to sort of ramp it up, the political agenda, again a bit.
Yeah, good point. It is really interesting, though, the way in which this is remaking the defence and security architecture of Europe, because you can see that while Putin's trying to play it long and hoping that there's a split in the West, and that essentially France and Germany decide, or that their original view or their view of a month ago rather than the view today, that Ukraine has to settle at some point, so there has to be some sort of negotiated settlement, that prevails just because there's war weariness. And as you say, the brave Ukrainians essentially run out of weaponry and people. But I mean, there's a counter to that, which is that the Ukrainians are, for all that they are taking huge, it's just the rate of attrition is very high. The Russians are not getting as far as they would have expected after a long, in this phase of the war, they've really poured everything into it. So I think, I don't know the answer. I mean, following various military historians and strategic experts on Twitter and elsewhere, and speaking to various people, it's kind of, we're going to know really by the autumn where that stands. I suppose his aim is, as those who favour some kind of deal at some point, Putin's aim is really to create a landlocked Ukraine. So a Ukraine with enormous, well, even bigger economic problems than it has now, that doesn't then have access to the sea and finds it more difficult to export grain and all the rest of it. But I do think I'm really, really heartened by what I term the northern emergence of the Northern Alliance, and you know, the Defence Secretary and the Prime Minister have referred to that in the past. That arc that's now appearing, which is Finland, Sweden, the Baltic states, there are problems politically there, but Poland particularly, Poland becoming absolutely pivotal country, determined to arm itself to the teeth, very, very realistic about Russian intentions and determined to scale up its defences. And then that stretching across to Britain and with the potential for a few other countries, and then Romania, which is not in the north, but is very robust for obvious reasons on this, and increasingly an ally of the countries that I described. So you've got, on the one hand, that's a split in the West, isn't it? Because that, you know, Britain and France are very close militarily and still have to cooperate. But that Northern Alliance theme, I think, is going to be, I don't think that this is a temporary development. I think that this is the big part of the story in terms of European security of the next 5 to 10 to 20 years.
I just hope it's sustained. Like you, I'm encouraged by that emergence of a potential new Northern Alliance. But we have heard these things before. I remember them, you know, after the early stages of the Iraq War. Now, obviously, the Iraq War went wrong, and so perhaps the alliance that was created to sustain it fell apart for reasons of just it had backed a very difficult course. But yeah. It's going to take a lot of statecraft, I think. And I don't know whether that, you know, there are rumours that our Defence Secretary, Ben Wallace, might become Secretary General of NATO. Actually, I wonder whether we need to create some new architecture, you know, formally some new architecture, you know, outside of NATO. I don't know, because we're already seeing NATO hit problems with, you know, Turkey wanting exact concessions from probably more money in order to get Sweden into NATO, perhaps a slightly more flexible alternative to NATO that can fight battles might need to be created.
But then the key question then is, where does America fit in all of this? Because on the one hand, there's a real, you speak to Americans at the moment, you know, who work in this field, and they'll tell you, look, you look out for the midterms. That could, and Biden has just got through a $40 billion package of military aid and related support for Ukraine. Phenomenal amount of American weaponry and help pouring in, but maybe that's the last package of that size. So it might become more complicated in the autumn. Don't know what the new dispensation in Congress will bring, and there's also just the fear that maybe America could become weary of it, or also distracted, because the big theme is on the other side of the world is what's coming on Taiwan and China, with America bipartisan consensus on confronting China or trying to deter China, but offering essentially what are beginning to sound more and more like guarantees to Taiwan. So you've got that unfolding as well. But then on the other hand, being positive about America is that, you know, even if Trump gets back, or someone who's minded to be slightly more isolationist, there just does seem to be this bipartisan broad consensus on defense and security in the US that the West is under attack. It might be under attack in two theaters. It might be Ukraine, and it might be Taiwan within 18 months. But I'm not sure it's just going to sort of fade away.
No, I'm certainly more optimistic about America on some of these global questions. And, you know, you're right to be concerned, as you know, about exhaustion. But it's one of the rare occasions, you know, when Congress has actually backed something, you know, that has come out of the White House. You know, almost, I think Rand Paul, the Libertarian senator from Kentucky, asked some pretty tough questions about whether this was a useful way to spend American taxpayers' money. But, you know, within his own Republican Party, he was a small minority. And I think actually this is an area where actually America is pretty, well, Well, no, correct that. I was going to say an area where America is pretty united. That perhaps isn't true, but it's where the American politicians are pretty united. I think there's probably a, if a populist candidate emerged, I think they could make the case that the American, that Washington was spending too much money on the war.
Yeah.
For the moment, Washington looks pretty solid in supporting.
Just, I mean, it's only, so it's the middle of 2022. It's really early in the cycle. Does Trump, I mean, where are you on the possibility of Trump at the moment?
My theory on Trump is that if he wants the Republican nomination, he'll get it. And I don't think these, I actually think these hearings that the Democrats are holding live at the moment are going to backfire on them. They look too political. And most Americans want their cost of living addressed. They want, you know, some real issues addressed. And it looks like the Democrats are obsessed against prosecuting a political case against Trump. And it's not as though the hearings are actually asking the tough questions about how the whole January the 6th incident happened. You know, they're not looking at why the Capitol Police weren't able to defend the Capitol, for example. It's all about Trump's role.
True.
In it. Now, Trump behaved disgracefully. Don't any of our listeners hear from me a defense of Trump in this. I'm not making that case at all. But I just think they're staging it the wrong way. The whole cinematic way they're broadcasting it as well. It looks like a tele commercial rather than an investigation into a very serious issue.
Yeah, I mean, I find the clips and stuff, I find them really compelling. The stuff about Trump's lawyers and the madness of that day and people trying to persuade him in the days leading up to it and afterwards that, no, of course the election wasn't stolen, and him just refusing to listen to reason. I find that compelling, but then I'm not, you know, well, it's not my country, so it's not for me to tell Americans who they should vote for, but I'm not a Trump fan remotely. So it's not designed, so the fact that it appeals to me as someone who's a Trump skeptic, or it doesn't really matter how it then lands with a Republican voter who has voted for Trump and is aware of his limitations but cuts him some slack is a different matter. And as you say, presumably just what's happening with cost of living is going to, that's really what's going to decide the midterms. And I noticed that Javier Blas, Bloomberg's brilliant energy correspondent, just highlighted this week, or on Friday, the first reports he'd heard of the administration thinking about essentially limiting exports on gas, basically, or on fuel.
Well, that really will frighten Europe.
Yeah, and now that doesn't mean that's definitely going to happen, but just the fact that someone with as much authority on the subject as Javier has heard these mutterings means, and we're only at the beginning of this process, and it's now $5 a gallon, which is very cheap by European standards, but with petrol rising in the US, this is surely the way, the direction in which things will go towards something that's a bit more isolationist and protectionist.
I'm going to say something that just shows how knowledgeable I am now.
Shoot.
America is quite large.
Now, I've heard this, yeah.
But why I say that, of course, is gas and oil, you know, Britain, you know, is not easy for people who live in rural areas, but actually getting from A to B in Britain, although we pay a lot more for petrol, is, you know, we have some alternatives. You know, we aren't covering great distances. A lot of Americans, just to get basic things done, whether to go get their kids to school, to go to work, to get deliveries for local stores. It's a big country. And actually, so when petrol prices, gas prices, they call it, go up, it was a much bigger deal for a country which is very spread out. It may sound like the obvious thing, but perhaps we don't appreciate how big a deal it is. And I'll come and eat my hat or my other garment on this podcast if I'm wrong, but I think the Democrats and Joe Biden will get walloped on a seismic scale in November. I think they will certainly lose the House big time, probably lose the Senate, although the Republicans have been choosing a few dodgy candidates again, and that's not going to help them. But to answer, you know, come back, so that could have a profound impact on American politics. Certainly make Joe Biden's, the second half of his first term will make him, you know, basically a lame duck very, very early. a lame duck who can't even remember to say quack. Very rude about him, but I think that's an under discussed phenomenon, really. How
And it turns out, and it's that alien. It's that so it's that inflation question again, which, you know, it turns out that those who warned about the stimulus were correct, and that actually the danger was overheating, and the last thing that that the US economy needed was an enormous splurge, which of course he'd promised in the election. And you know, that coupled with you know, overly lax policy, and then I suppose just the money printing that just kind of went too far. And you know, I think we all just have to hope that, as I say, that in the West we catch a lucky break. Shall we wrap it up there, Tim, for this week?
Yeah, can I just answer the Trump question there, which I think we got from incredibly quickly? I think my thing on Trump is, I think he wants to win the next election and be vindicated, but he doesn't want to be president again. That's right. The sense of it I get. So, yes, he can win the nomination, but how does he... His decision, I think, will be taking on how much does he need that justification of winning again to the fact that he's actually got quite a nice life post-presidency. He didn't always enjoy being president, and he's going to have to balance that in his own mind. But I think it's Trump's decision. The Republican Party probably will embrace him.
But he's also an American politician, said to me that he is... who was recently passing through London, said that he is raising huge amounts of money, which effectively fund his operation. So he kind of needs the money.
And he can't be, I think there's certain laws that if he's actually running for the presidency, he can't be sued by various tax and other authorities. I can't remember the specifics of it, but he certainly has levels of immunity as a candidate that wouldn't be available to him as a private citizen. And so that might tip the balance into him running.
What a thought. I mean, bring back Harry Truman, Ronald Reagan, or just about any of the predecessors.
Nixon even.
Well, there'll be people listening to this saying that he was hard done by. Yes, I'll sit on the fence on that one. But Tim, it's been really fantastic talking to you. We covered a lot there. I'm sorry to listeners if it was a bit gloomy. I mean, we did start with England's amazing win at Trent Bridge, and there's a really lovely piece on reaction for subscribers by our sports columnist Alan Massey on Saturday morning, which actually explains how England, how Burstow and Root did it. So look out for that on the site. Until next time, you've been listening to the Reaction Podcast with me, Ian Martin, and my guest, Tim Montgomery. Thank you very much for listening.